State v. Duffman. State v. Duffman.
Your Honor, it's Doofman.
Doofman.
He has reminded me of that multiple times.
I was so happy just to get the F sound in there. Doofman.
May it please the court, Timothy Norlinger on behalf of the appellee, Mr. Doofman. This is a conviction after a jury trial in Nemaha County, which is Auburn, Nebraska. The operative facts in this case involve the appellee, Sean Doofman, going to a bar located in downtown Auburn, at which point he is served by Luis Lopez, who is the bar owner, along with a bartender who is also present at the bar. At some point, there is a discussion about a large knife, which Mr. Doofman did not have concealed on his person. It was on his hip. Eventually, based on the totality of the testimony in the case, it appears that Mr. Doofman was asked to take the knife out to his vehicle. He did not do so. It was then placed behind the bar, and he was served for a period of time. After that point, there is a divergence between the testimony with regard to what happened and at the case. Mr. Doofman was able to call another patron that was at the bar on that date, who also testified consistent with his version of events. That's a Mr. Gilliland, G-I-L-L-I-L-A-N-D. They indicate that Mr. Doofman then attempted to leave the bar, at which point he requested the knife from the bartender and Mr. Lopez. It was tendered to him, and then he left without further incident, is essentially what their testimony is.
But that witness did not see how the knife was returned to Mr. Doofman, did he?
No, that's true, Judge. What he does say is he doesn't recall any type of confrontation or screaming matches, which would be consistent with what the bartender and Mr. Lopez said indicated inside the bar here. So at least there appears to be two very different versions of events, one presented by the appellee and his witness, and one by the alleged victim and the bartender, who was also a witness to the case. The appeal in this case centers around essentially ineffective assistance of counsel claims and a sufficiency of the evidence argument. The sufficiency of the evidence argument I won't deal with in oral argument. I think that's sufficient on the brief. I wanted to address more the ineffective assistance claims, which I spent most of my time in the reply brief touching on. The first one deals with questions that were done during voir dire of the prospective panel. This is Auburn, having been an adjoining county attorney at one point in Nebraska City. I realize that everybody knows everybody in those small areas, and this is going to happen. However, it was very clear from some of the prospective jurors who were actually placed on the panel that they had personal relationships with the county attorney for the appellant that tried the case, Louis Ligori. I'm appellant counsel. Keith Kolasch, the public defender, was trial counsel on this case. Mr. Kolasch did not inquire of any of those prospective jurors that were then placed on the panel exactly what their relationship was with Mr. Ligori, how that would affect their ability to be fair and impartial, and we are preserving that for post-conviction relief. Obviously, that appears not to be sufficient with the record contained here, but Mr. Kolasch, I think, was deficient in his performance with regard to that issue.
And both of those jurors, when they were asked, indicated that their relationship or knowledge with the witnesses would cause no problem.
Right.
Was that their response?
That was their response. However, making an allegation that there was no further inquiry by the appellee's counsel to ensure that was the case. That was a very brief kind of inquiry by the court and the appellant's counsel as part of the initial stages of voir dire. Nobody dug into the relationships to see if there was any further issue that may have given rise to either, you know, there being a strike for cause or, frankly, a peremptory strike with regard to more information being disclosed with regard to those. With regard to the next argument with regard to ineffective assistance, that centers around some impeachment evidence that was attempted to be presented at trial but was unsuccessfully done, essentially. And this case obviously involves four essential witnesses, I think, and two for the appellee, two for the appellant. Mr. Kolasch identified during some of the exchange after the appellant had rested in its case in chief that he wanted to play some videos of Mr. Lopez and the bartender regarding inconsistent statements that were given to law enforcement prior to or subsequent to this assault that occurred more contemporaneously than their testimony. He, however, failed to properly question the appellant's witnesses with regard to this issue to properly preserve and be able to present the impeachment evidence. Obviously, the appellee believes that that is important in this case, is one of the things that really differentiates one set of facts versus the other, is the reliability of the witnesses in this case and who the jury chose to believe. Obviously, the appellee was convicted, but the impeachment evidence, based on what I've been able to review and is clear from the record, Mr. Kolasch was trying to present it, was something that would call into question parts that were seminal to the ultimate testimony about whether or not Mr. Doofman attempted to stab Mr. Lopez with this knife as he jumped back out of the way, as is contained in the trial transcript. With regard to the next ineffective claim, that centers around improper opinion evidence under 27701, Rule 701. Ultimately, the appellant was able to get out of both the bartender and Mr. Lopez some testimony with regard to intent on the part of Mr. Doofman that was not objected to during the trial by Mr. Kolasch, who was trial counsel for the appellee.
Are you talking about the testimony of if he hadn't jumped back, he would have struck him?
Essentially, that is...
Is that opinion evidence, or is that based upon personal observation?
Well, I think that is an interesting question. I think they're rendering an opinion under 701 as to what they believe would have happened if they didn't jump back, and it goes beyond merely observation. At least that's the argument that I've made in my brief, and I realize that counsel for the appellant makes a different argument with regard to it. But in any case, it was not objected to. I cannot tell you whether it was strategy or not, but I think a failure to properly object to that was something that should be able to be preserved and raised on a post-conviction relief motion should Mr. Doofman choose to do it. The last assignment of error on ineffective assistance of counsel centers around Rule 404, 27404 evidence.
Was there a hearing, 404 hearing?
No, not from what I can tell, either through the journal entries on the record, nor at any point during the pre-trial bill of exceptions that I reviewed. It does not appear that there was any type of 404 subsection 3 hearing with regard to this aggressive behavior of Mr. Doofman after he was arrested by law enforcement.
The state's argument is essentially trial counsel for Mr. Doofman in opening remarks indicated that he was not being confrontational, he was being calm. And so is that enough to say the door was open so that this was proper impeachment?
I don't think so, because just mentioning, obviously, as this court is aware, opening is not evidence. Ultimately, it's evidence in this case. The case that I think most, and the other argument I thought that maybe the appellant would raise would be an inextricably linked or intertwined, however you want to do it. But I'd point this court to State v. Ash, 286 Nebraska 681. It's a Supreme Court opinion, and I will admit there is a dissenting opinion from the Chief Justice and Justice Castle with regard to this issue. But the majority in that case said that even though it was a murder case, even though the alleged murderer had a jacket from the decedent that they pawned within a day of the alleged murder, that still required the prophylactic guarantees outlined under Rule 404, meaning the hearing that Judge Moore mentioned, as well as limiting instruction should defense counsel wish to include it. Because of, again, as I mentioned, you essentially have two different versions of events. You have the appellant's witnesses and the appellee and his witness testifying inconsistent with each other. Obviously, that aggressive kind of standoff with law enforcement that both the deputies disclosed after the fact appears to have been evidence to show something under 404, a common theme and aggressiveness by the defendant, something to that extent. Obviously, 404 subsection 2 is not an extensive list, but it would be the defense's argument that there should have been a hearing, it should have been objected to, and it prejudiced the appellee in this case because that's further evidence that eroded his version of events without a limiting instruction as to what purpose it was being included for.
Would you agree that if we concluded that that was an error and reversed this, that double jeopardy principles wouldn't preclude another trial?
I would think at that point that I would agree, Judge. I'm going to reserve the little time I have left, so thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Siobhan Duffy, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee, the state of Nebraska. Appellant argues the evidence was insufficient to support his convictions and that he received ineffective assistance of counsel. The state believes the evidence presented, when taken in the light most favorable to the state, was sufficient to support the convictions and that his ineffective assistance of counsel claims are either without merit or unable to be addressed on the record before this court on direct appeal.
Can we jump right to the Rule 404 issue, if you
yes,
don't
Your
mind? I think in your brief you argued that it was inextricably intertwined evidence. Can you explain how that was so?
Yes, Your Honor. I think, and to clarify, the state did mention in brief that in opening statements, trial counsel at that time for defendant, kind of discussed how the state and the appellant would be presenting different versions of the events. That the state's version would be he was being aggressive, and that his version would be that he was just acting normally in a normal manner, and that his actions were misinterpreted by the bartender and the bar owner. Just as our general framework, under inextricably intertwined evidence, the state is entitled to present a coherent picture of the facts of the crime charge. And Rule 404 is inadmissible or inapplicable to this evidence.
How is what happened after what took place in the bar relevant to what took place in the bar?
Yes. Well, Your Honor, I think it's important to remember the events of the evening didn't stop when appellant exited the bar.
He actually waited for the police.
He testified that he was waiting for the police. Deputy Burris, the first deputy on the scene, testified that when he came to the bar, that appellant was attempting to, I believe, attach the chin strap. He was on a motorcycle to, like, the helmet. So I think that maybe you could infer that he was going to leave. He claimed he was waiting, but in any event, it was very shortly in time after he'd exited the bar. And then Deputy, I believe, Medeiros transported appellant from the bar to the station. So both were testifying about events that occurred within the portion of that evening. And I think the state pointing out in our brief that trial counsel referenced the events of the entire evening show that these were all part of the facts of the crime charge, what was going on that evening. And I recognize that it is subsequent in time. And I will direct this court in State v. Wasinski, 268 NEB 778. It's a 2004 case from the Nebraska Supreme Court. In that case, an appellant was accused of stealing items from a home, and he was apprehended 10 days later in a truck that had been stolen separately from the items with the home, and stolen items from the home were also in that truck. And at trial, testimony came out that the truck had been stolen, that items from the that did not belong to the truck owner were recovered in the truck, and that was...
So there is precedent that subsequent acts can apply
yes,
as well
sure.
as the prior acts, but again, I'm trying to get to the significance or what independent relevance was there, really, as to the aggressive behavior with the officers and what happened in the bar.
Again, Your Honor, I think the testimony from both as you know, noted that both sides had kind of a different version of events. The state presented evidence that throughout the evening that the appellant was in the bar twice, that the first time he was in the bar, he had at least a verbal altercation with another patron, he left.
Was that objected to, by the way?
I don't recall that it was, Your mm-hmm. Honor. I don't recall it mm-hmm. right now. But so there was testimony that prior to there had been a verbal altercation. He left. He came back to the bar. He's had the knife on his hip the first time at the bar as well as the second. And then obviously had the altercation with the bar owner. And then immediately thereafter was so the state's theory was that the entire evening is relevant because we're trying to determine whether, as appellant claims, this was accidental or misinterpreted as he was simply retrieving his knife and leaving, or if this was
an attempted second-degree assault as charged in the information.
Isn't the evidence really trying to, by bringing in the officer's testimony, trying to show that he acted in conformity with the behavior that occurred in the bar?
Well, no, Your Honor, I think it's just giving a picture of the entire evening. I don't think that the state is allowed to present a coherent picture of the facts of the crime.
But what happened in the bar, there's a clear picture. You have witnesses providing testimony as to what happened in the bar, and that's what he's charged with, is the assault in the bar.
But I think it's also relevant immediately thereafter what happened, especially when one version of events is that this was all happening in a calm manner, and appellant went outside and waited for the police because he testified that he said he did nothing wrong. And so
you're saying it can be used as impeachment?
I suppose in a sense, Your Honor, I still think ultimately the state's argument is that these were all part of the crime charge, that the entire evening is relevant in this case, and that these facts are inextricably intertwined. That the state is...
What was the crime charged?
The crime charge was attempted second-degree assault in possession of a weapon during commission of a felony.
But not towards any of the officers?
Correct, Your Honor. I still think ultimately it comes down to, was this evidence inextricably intertwined? And again, the state is entitled to present a coherent picture of the crime charged, and there is precedent for subsequent acts to be included in that.
One of the cases about subsequent acts, I think it was the Veach case, and that was, I think, some 15 months after the act. But in any event, there was a limiting instruction given to the jury. Was that done in this case?
Your Honor, I don't believe so, no, because there was no 404 hearing. So the state's position is that this was not 404 evidence, so there was no requirement for a limiting instruction. Ultimately, the state believes that this was not 404 evidence and thus not subject to a prior hearing or to that limiting instruction, and that it was all relevant to the facts of the crime charge, and that trial counsel was thus not ineffective in failing to object under Rule 404. Unless this court wishes to continue to discuss that assignment of error, I will move and address appellant's ineffective assistance of counsel claim as it relates to what he claims was improper opinion testimony by Hutchings, who was the bartender, and Lopez, the bar owner. Appellant argues trial counsel should have objected. He claims this was improper opinion testimony about whether the knife would have struck Lopez had he not jumped back out of the way. Appellant argued in brief that this invaded the province of the jury, and he alleges it was not based on the witness's perception of the events. The state disagrees. Both Hutchings and Lopez were testifying to what they observed based on where the parties were located, the movement of appellant's arms. Their statements that the knife would have struck Lopez had he not jumped out of the way were based on their observations, their perceptions, and their knowledge.
Didn't one of them have an obstructed view, though?
A partially obstructed view, Hutchings did, and I believe appellant pointed out in brief that she stated she couldn't recall which hand was holding the knife, but I don't think that that equates to the finding that she couldn't see anything. She clearly said she saw that based on what she saw, had Lopez not jumped back, the knife would have struck him. I believe she may have said he slashed kind of with like a forward motion. I don't recall her exact statement, but I do believe there was testimony it was partially obstructed, but again, I don't think that leads to the finding that she was just kind of testifying based on what someone else had told her. She testified that she did see what occurred. And this testimony was further helpful to the jury to explain the observations of both Hutchings and Lopez about whether the knife would have struck him, Lopez, had he not jumped back. So the state does not believe that this was improper opinion testimony and that an objection to it would not have been successful. And so trial counsel was not ineffective in failing to do so. I believe appellant's other claims of ineffective assistance of counsel are addressed in brief, unless this court has specific questions on those. Very briefly, for the sufficiency of the evidence, appellant's argument really is based on what he sees as discrepancies between the state's witnesses' testimony and the witnesses that he presented. And this court on appeal does not resolve conflicts in evidence or reweigh the evidence or pass on the credibility of witnesses. In this case, that was for the finder of fact, so the jury, and they found the state's witnesses to be more credible, and we believe that the evidence presented was sufficient to support the convictions. If there are no additional questions from this court, we ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
How much time does the appellant have left?
Not very long.
Did you hear the response?
Yeah, 25 seconds. Okay, I thought it was about 30. So to the Judge Moore's point with regard to the argument that occurred beforehand, I think that illustrates the key difference between 404 and inextricably intertwined. I didn't raise the argument beforehand because I think that's intertwined in the state's version of what occurred. It's this conflict with Deputy Burris outside the bar, and then furthermore, after he's arrested, the squaring up of the shoulders at Deputy Menderos that appear to be for a limited purpose to show his aggressive behavior that attempts to paint him in a negative light without any type of limiting instruction or the prophylactic hearing beforehand to have the court weigh that, and that's the main issue, and I think that is the main difference between those two issues under 404.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Case is submitted. Counsel, you're excused.
Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of your tour.